If you like math, secrets, privacy, and cryptocurrency, today's guest is right up your alley. David Wong is a security engineer currently working for Facebook with deep expertise in blockchain and more generally, cryptography. After earning his bachelor's in math and his master's in cryptography, David has worked for the likes of Matasano Security, NCC Group, and now Facebook. In addition to his day job, David is the author of the upcoming Manning Publications book titled Real World Cryptography, which you can purchase now in early access from Manning.com. Speaking of Manning, as always, we are doing a giveaway with this episode. For the first five people who email us here at hello@developmentor.com, we will give you a code good for one free ebook copy of David's book. If you don't want to email or you're too late on that, you can use the discount code PODDEVMEN20, that's PODDEVMEN20, for 40% off David's book as well as all other Manning books. All right, let's dive into our interview with David Wong and hear how this cryptography expert has built a career at the center of some of today's hottest tech topics.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Hey, David, thanks so much for joining me here on Developmentor. I'm so glad we had a chance to connect.
Hey, Grin. Thanks for having me.
Now, as I understand it, you're normally in San Francisco, but working remote these days from San Diego. How's that been going for you?
Pretty good. I have the beach next to me, so that I think that was the right choice with all that lockdown.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So, you know, and San Diego is one of my favorite California cities, just, you know, that constant sunshine and the beach. So it sounds like you're enjoying it really well there.
Yeah, it's growing in me too. So that's favorite city as well.
It's going to be interesting to see how many people who have fled San Francisco decide to go back, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I heard someone saying that if, like, for the dot-com bubble, the same sort of thing happened and then everybody came back. And everybody always goes back to San Francisco. So we'll see how it goes. But more and more companies are moving to like full remote and these kind of things. So I'm not sure how it's going to go. But
real quick for our listeners, what's one or two tips that have helped you better work remotely?
Tips that help me work remotely. So that's interesting. I've been working remotely before, so that's not new to me. I'd say one of the first problem that you hit when you start working remotely is really not being able to understand when your work day starts and when it ends. So it's kind of a hard tip because it's not easy to follow, but understanding when the days end and stopping work and going back to your normal life and forcing yourself to do that is, I think, the first thing you need to do when you work remotely. Otherwise, you just work forever and you never stop working. That's not good for your morale.
Yeah, I always just say, you know, one of the downsides of working from home is you're always at the office,
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the downside.
One thing I just started doing recently is I actually put an end of day event on my calendar that repeats every day at roughly the same time. I don't always adhere to it, but it's that mental, like, you know, notification that says, all right, it's time to stop.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think the more physical you can be, like, what I mean is if you can have like a big red light in your apartment that lights up when you finish working, you know, like at whatever, like 6 p.m. or something like that, that's like a physical sign, you know, signal.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Or maybe, you know, like it ejects you from your office or something. Yeah, that's fantastic. David, you know, let's dive in here. I would love to just start off, such a fascinating background working around the world here. And I'm curious, you know, like, what inspired you to get into math, tech, cryptography? Take us back to, I don't know, 10-year-old David, 15-year-old David, 18-year-old David, where this really emerged from you and you felt like, this is what I want to go do.
So yeah, so I work in security / cryptography, and I feel like it's not an easy field to run into. It's not the kind of thing you learn in school necessarily, or at least back then. So I kind of ended up here by pure luck, I would say. If I'm taking you back when I was younger, they were the two ingredients that I needed to get into that field. And these were mathematics and computer science. I started coding early as a kid. My father kind of taught me how to use BASIC, I don't know how to say it, on this old calculator. So it was not even a computer. I had to like write the line numbers manually and all these things on the calculator. And I would write simple programs and games and things like that. So I kind of started there for computer science, and I never really stopped. I got more into programming as in middle school, and I was making websites and all that kind of stuff. The other facet was mathematics. I guess I've always been good at math, and like a lot of kids who didn't know what they wanted to do, I just went more into math because that's the only path that seemed to be open in front of me. I think I remember most people saying that you shouldn't do a career in computer science. At least back then, it was not really a field that I think it was starting to become something new, but it was not seen as glamorous. You know, it was like IT. You would like repair computers or something like that.
I had somebody close to me who was like, oh, you know, it's just a fad, or it's, you know, like it's not ever going to lead to a really productive career. But that was way back when. So,
yeah. And people were making fun of me because I was spending too much time with computers. And it's definitely not the same as today, where you kind of have these like tech rock stars and it's cool to work in tech and these kind of things. So that has changed.
Now, David, you're the first cryptologist we've had on the show. So take a moment and explain what it is for our listeners. You know, what is this field about, and what are perhaps some of the challenges one would face if they were working in the field of cryptology?
Yeah, so cryptography or cryptology, it doesn't really matter, the distinction, but it's a field that started as, imagine two characters, Alice and Bob, and people like to use these two characters usually. And they want to exchange some messages. Maybe they're writing each other letters, love letters, whatever, doesn't matter. It's their own, you know, business. And they really don't want anybody else to be able to see these messages. And cryptography is pretty much the solution to that problem. When you have participants, so Alice and Bob, who wants to do something together, but are scared of adversaries, of people that would be in the middle looking at their mail, looking at their communications and being able to spy on that. That's how cryptography started, with the necessity of encrypting communications, right? Hiding communications from these observers. It was, I believe, always more of a military thing in the beginning, but no, it started to become all sorts of things. And you know, today you and I, or anybody else listening to this show, is using cryptography without even knowing it. It's very transparent. But it all started from the study of how can we hide communications from observers, if that makes sense.
And for our listeners, you know, just the minute you type in HTTPS, you are doing cryptography. If you drop that little S, then you're not.
Exactly. That's the perfect example. Every day you use cryptography a number of times just by visiting the web, right? Just going on Facebook, YouTube, and Gmail, and et cetera.
What are some of the key skills one needs? You know, so you've got this math and computer science background, but you know, what are some of the key skills? Are there specific areas of math or programming one should be familiar with, or is it just generally any type of math? Like, hey, I'm good at math, like linear algebra or calculus, so I'm going to be okay in cryptography, or do I need to go really get into some much more niche area?
Yeah, that's a good question, especially if you want to get into that field. So I'd say first, cryptography is a very, very big field. And you have this kind of distinction between the more theoretical world of cryptography and the more applied world of cryptography, which I also call real world cryptography. And depending where you are on that spectrum, you might need different skills. So I'd say that nowadays I don't do as much math as I used to do when I was a student. And so from that perspective, because I'm in the more applied world, you don't need to have a math degree or anything like that. As long as you have an interest and you're willing to spend a bit of effort getting to it, I think it's everybody can get into that. Now, if you want to do more research and more theoretical work, maybe construct crypto systems or cryptographic algorithms, or if you want to attack them and try to, you know, break encryption and these kind of things, then you do need to have some, you know, math skills. But these are things that you can learn. What's hard is to have this baseline, being able to read math. But as soon as you can read math, or as soon as you get over that, there's a lot of resources, and I think anybody can learn and get more into it and maybe become a researcher from small understanding of mathematics to a better one.
It's been interesting watching the cryptography field grow, much like the machine learning field, where, you know, the usage of these things is commonplace. So for many programmers, it's just like, hey, there's this function that encrypts things and decrypts things, and just like there is with machine learning. So you can kind of be on one side of the API or the other when it comes to your career, and both are really viable and really interesting. Has that been your experience? Because it looks like from your background, you kind of have gone back and forth. You're doing a bit of both, right?
So I like the way you put it. I see cryptography as a bunch of black boxes inside other black boxes, and it's kind of up to you to figure out which ones you want to open. Or maybe like, you know, like these Russian dolls. The more you get into it, the harder it becomes and the more math you need.
And maybe one more round of definitions, just because, you know, this field does have a lot of pretty hardcore math, et cetera. One of the other areas that maybe our listeners are familiar with is cryptocurrency and blockchain. Maybe they've heard those two. But, you know, real quick, give a layperson's definition of those, just in case they come up as we're talking about, you know, these subjects.
Yeah, so cryptocurrency has the word crypto in it. And the sole reason, or an important reason, is that it's based on cryptography and it's a currency, right? So that's the other word. So just think of it as a digital currency. So yeah, every day you send money using, I don't know, like, or not every day, but if you use your credit card, or if you use a bank transfer or Venmo or something like that, what's really happening is that it's a digital transfer of money. You're not using cash, right? And so there's different ways to implement that. Banks have different ways of doing it. But cryptocurrency is a new way to do it using cryptography elements, cryptography ingredients, to obtain different properties. So that's kind of the definition from a high level, right? Yeah, it's some sort of new paradigm, a new concept of building something that we know and we've used for many years, but in a very different way. And so it provides more, you'll hear people saying trust or these kind of things, or there's no single point of failure. That's a high level definition.
That's fantastic. And for our listeners, we'll, you know, of course, try to link up some resources that can help you understand some of these concepts and terms. You know, coming back then into your career, you know, there's kind of a couple of angles to take here, but you know, from looking on your profile, it seems like you've moved at least a number of times around the globe. I believe you had some time in France, some time in Chicago, and time in San Francisco. Walk me through a little bit kind of your career and this growth and this movement around the globe and some of these key inflection points, if you will, as you've been trying to figure out just exactly what David wants to do with his career.
Yeah. I mean, I've been traveling forever, I guess, but lately, it might look like I was traveling for work, but the reality is that I was trying to stay in the US and I couldn't because of visa issues. So I basically had to move out of the US, out of Chicago at the time, and go to somewhere else while I was waiting for the green card. The place I chose was London at the time. When I got back to the US, when I finally got the green card, I kind of went back to my childhood and I was like, what did I dream of when I was a kid? And I remember thinking of the Silicon Valley and kind of this tech world that used to live in the Bay. And I was like, that's where I want to go. If I'm going back to the US, let's go to a place that's really going to be, you know, cool. And also, it was too cold in Chicago.
But then also, you did your master's in France. Is that right?
France and Canada. Also,
France and Canada. Ah, okay. So, you know, walk me through that a little bit, you know, because I think for a lot of people listening to the show or just in general, and when it comes to building their skill set, their careers. One of the questions often is, you know, I've got my bachelor's degree. Should I go get a master's? What motivated you to make that decision to go back and get your master's? And then how did you approach it? And it sounds like you split some time between two different places. So how did that all come about and how has it worked out for you?
The answer I'm going to give you will be unsatisfactory for any American listeners, I believe, because in France, it's very typical to do a master if you got a bachelor. And it's very rare to start up at a bachelor degree. Most people will tell you, like, you can find a job if you just have a bachelor. So you have to do a master.
Gotcha. But you started in Canada, started in France. Like, how did that come about?
Yeah. So actually, I did part of my bachelor in Canada. So after a bachelor is of mathematics. So that's the moment where you have to decide what you do next, usually as a French student. So you don't stop at a bachelor. And what you do next is more tricky because it's easy to go from high school to university. You just figure out, okay, what's the topic where I was the best or something like that. So initially I went into physics. I dropped out and I went back to mathematics, which was always my forte. But after your bachelor, that's when you have to make a more important decision because that's when you're going to find the topic that's going to lead to a job. And doing mathematics, doing theoretical mathematics, I can tell you that I was pretty panicked because you don't really get to do internships. You don't really get to understand what a job looks like. And so at the time, I remember thinking that there's no way I'll ever find a job. Like I was not fit to work because the skills I was learning were very abstract and very theoretical. Maybe I had a career in academia, but that's not really what I wanted. So what I did one summer in my bachelor degree, I was working at McDonald's at the time. And in between working hours, I would go to the library. I used to love going to the library just because there's a work atmosphere. And I would take classes. And I think at the time, that's when Coursera became a thing. So for anybody listening, if you don't know Coursera, that's amazing. Because you can try different topics, you can from different Ivy League universities and see what you like. And at the time, I was in between math and computer science, as I told you, and I was trying to figure out something that would please me, that would, you know, be exciting for me. And that's when Coursera became a thing. So I tried some physics courses and I tried some different courses. There's an amazing course on how to learn there as well. And then I found out this course on cryptography called Cryptography 1 by Dan Bonnet. And I took this course and it was so amazing. So I passed it that summer. It was so amazing that I pretty much applied to all the master's degree or a master's program that I could find, telling them that I had passed this course and everything and got accepted to all of them and pretty much chose where I wanted to go. So that's kind of how I got into my master.
Ah, that's fantastic. So, okay. So then, you know, you go get your master's. And like you said, this is kind of, at least in France, this is the gateway to getting your job. So what comes next? How were you thinking about your career at that point? Was it like, hey, I'm going to go get a job in France? You know, you mentioned this pull towards San Francisco. You mentioned some green card aspects throughout all of this. You know, how was David thinking about, I'm going to get started in the real world now?
So I think the missing elements from my education up until that point was internships. And I think that's something where America is much better than France. Although I don't have the full picture, but I feel like in America, you tend to do much more, many more internships in your education. And they tend to also come earlier. I don't know if that's true, but that's kind of the image that I have.
Yeah, I would say I've seen, you know, I'm even surprised these days. I see like quote unquote kids, I call them kids, but even high school doing professional internships as well as like right after your freshman year in college. Whereas I didn't really start on them till junior year or after my sophomore year, I guess.
Yeah, I've actually interviewed kids that wanted an internship at NCC Group when I was a consultant who were in high school and who were incredibly good. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, that's really cool. And so I think this is when it starts growing in you. You start understanding, okay, what does it mean to work? What skills do companies actually look for? How do they make money? I think that's one thing that was really missing from my understanding is how all do these companies make money? How can they give you money, right? How can they pay you? How can they afford that? And so I think internships was really the turning point for me to understand that and to really getting me motivated to learn more about cryptography. Like it really motivated me in my studies, kind of giving you, you know, this application. If you've been like learning math for a while and you're just playing with numbers, and I give you a real world problem saying if you solve that, you actually solve compression or encryption or something like that. I find that much more exciting than just doing theoretical stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I have a math degree as well. And, you know, and then once you got to apply it, it was just all of a sudden like this unlocking of things. I mean, the theory is fun too, but it's more of like a puzzle kind of thing is how I thought about it. But then once you actually get to work on it and apply it and see the outputs from it, then you're like, oh, this is amazing. Especially if you can then make it go fast and you can scale it and all those.
So maybe you can relate with that, but I remember a classmate of mine saying that mathematics is probably the least rewarding field of study. You have to learn a lot before you feel like you've gone through a breakthrough or, you know, like you've really understood something. Whereas when you apply something, you have these quick rewards. You don't spend like a year learning something before you finally achieve something.
Yeah, I could see that's true. I mean, I look at it as like they're just different types of rewards and they're both satisfying, right? You know, like there's something to be said for seeing the output right away or end within a reasonable, but there's also something to be said for kind of chewing on that problem over a long time. I mean, I can remember, and maybe you had this experience too, where you were given a proof on Monday and it was due on Friday. And just like your brain would sit and chew on that problem or those problems for the entire week. And then, you know, you finally have those aha moments along the way that slowly get you to it. And that was really satisfying to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm weird.
I mean, that's not that you're right, but I feel like a week is a good time. Extend that to 6 months and it takes a different type of mind to see through that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was definitely like, you know, you're doing college coursework, whereas then like the professors, you know, they've been working on one problem for 10 years kind of thing. That's a little different. So, well, bringing it back then, you know, you go to Montesano, you go to NCC, like looks like you've had a couple of different roles throughout this time, ranging from consulting through to engineering. Were you specifically seeking out different types of roles, or was that what was available and you got the job? Like, how have those roles played out for you during your career?
So I don't think everybody does that, but one thing I've always did ever since I was looking for internships was always to really look around. So I started that with my internship. For example, I had offers that I was very satisfied with. I was prepared to accept them, but I still took interviews, maybe just for fun or maybe just to meet some other people, just to see what was out there. And I actually ended up choosing something that I would not have chosen initially if I had not really continued this interview process. So I was never supposed to go to Chicago, for example. I was supposed to do an internship at Quark's Lab or at Crypto Expert in Paris, which were amazing opportunities. And then I went for Matasano, which was another amazing opportunity. And it was in Chicago, so it was also quite interesting to start this new cryptography services. I'd say this is really what kind of led me through different opportunities. It was always to really spend the time to see what's out there, to really interview in different types of positions, talk to different people, try to get their insight, try to see what they would advise you to apply for, or if they have any leads for you. And really, once you have different offers or different opportunities, see which one excites you more.
Any practical tips for our listeners when it comes to evaluating those or knowing perhaps when to keep seeking out versus it's time to make a decision?
So every time when you have an offer, they have this thing where they try to pressure you to accept as fast as possible. So it becomes very difficult to kind of continue looking for something else. I'd say two things. Don't let yourself be pressured in taking a quick decision if you're not sure that this is the role you want. Especially when you're at the beginning of your career and you get an offer, you're so excited and you're so scared that that's the only offer you're going to get. You're not going to say no, or you're not going to kind of ask, you know, like, can I take a week or 2 weeks to answer to you? Like I'm talking to others. And it's a really difficult decision to take, the decision to say no to something that sounds good enough and is a safe path towards your career. So that's the first thing I would say is, especially if you're in tech, understand that if you have one offer, you're probably going to have several offers. It's not true for every field, but tech is hiring. We're in a good position right now. So keep going. Don't be afraid to say no or to ask for more time to decide. I'd say the second thing is really don't be afraid to just try and apply for any sorts of role and to reach out to people directly and talk to people. Even if you know you're not going to pass the interview, like you're always going to learn something. You're always going to meet people who might lead you to another opportunity on the long run. And once you find something that you really like, I think you know it. I think it's pretty easy to figure out which path to take, or at least it was for me.
Yeah, I agree. Now, reflecting back a little bit, you know, as you've progressed, I think you've been, you know, out in the quote unquote real world. I keep using the real world because I'm trying to set up your book here, but I love that phrase. And reflect a little bit, you know, you just mentioned some of the keys around hiring, but reflect a little bit more broadly on some of the key lessons you've learned in your career that have helped guide and shape the path you've taken.
One thing that I've underestimated first was creating connections and relationships. And it took me a while to understand that creating connections and relationships was or should be a priority in your career. Not only outside of your work, but inside of your work too. It's much more easy to work with people or to get something done or to agree with people or even to disagree with people if you have a relationship with them. And so taking the time to build these relationships is actually a very good investment in terms of productivity and opportunities within your work. And I think that's something that we tend to forget. That's something I think we learn faster at Facebook because that's a more social company. And so they kind of privilege social interactions. But I think that's true for any type or any size organizations.
Was there anything specific that unlocked that for you, like a book or a mentor or, you know, I don't know, a bad interaction that made you realize you needed to get better at that?
I'd say trial and error, especially in the kind of environment where I'm working, is you can quickly see that people you have a relationship with are easier to work with, especially when you need to delegate or collaborate or any kind of teamwork. Is extremely hard if you don't have these connections in place or if you don't have a good connection with someone. That's definitely one lesson. I guess working through friction is something as well. That's something you find in research. The people who succeed are always the one who persist, and giving up is always very easy, especially in our field. You know, it's easy to leave your company and find another job. And that's not really a good way to answer to friction. You're always going to meet friction in your job or in your life, and working through the challenges, working with the constraints, instead of saying, oh, they don't care about this, or nobody wants me to do this, or I can't achieve this because people are not letting me do it. I think the right attitude is always to work against the friction and insist. And if you believe in something, push for it. And that's when you learn good lessons, and that's when you can achieve great work, I would say. And of course, you know, don't be married with your ideas. If you're wrong, you should be able to quickly figure that out, but also don't give up easily.
On the friction front, you know, I love that narrative. What's helped you with that? You know, how have you approached it? You know, again, kind of same question, any mentors, books, et cetera, learnings that have really helped you there, or is, again, trial and error?
So for that, I actually have a good recommendation. There is a book called The Phoenix Project. Have you heard of it?
I have not, no.
It's a DevOps book. So there was another book called The Goal, which was a novel telling you about real lessons. And the author believed that by learning a story and finding the conclusions by yourself, they would stick with you instead of just reading about the results. So going back to the Phoenix Project, it kind of teaches you how developers work with ops or personalizations and production engineers and security and all these different groups inside of an organization, the same way a manufacturing line works. And so it kind of abstracts the different groups and the different people into kind of working stations. And it sees work or different types of work as moving between these different working stations. And some working stations are constraints. They can easily become the bottleneck of all the manufacturing line. And so you have to understand how to be efficient about moving from these raw products to the end user at the end, when you assemble everything and you deliver the product. So that was a good lesson on friction, how to change your mind, how to work within the constraints of your company or the constraint that were put in place before you, and kind of turn that around and become efficient. And it takes time, it takes effort, it takes sweat, and it's stressful, and it's not always easy, but it's very rewarding, and much more rewarding than giving up and, you know, quitting your job or something like that. So that's good recommendation, the Phoenix project.
We'll link that up in the show notes. I already pulled it up on Amazon. We'll have that in the show notes. It begs the question then too, though, is when do you know when it's time to move on? I don't like necessarily the word give up, but, you know, every job kind of has a lifespan, I like to think. How do you go about identifying that?
If I think about it now, I can think of at least a few ways, a few heuristics to kind of understand if it's the time to move on or not. One thing is, of course, toxicity. You don't want your work to become toxic or to burn you out or anything like that. There's always a phase in between, of course. And if you keep working through it, you can end up on the right side. But sometimes your work becomes toxic, and sometimes it's just better to give up. Not just give up and quit, but also give up and stop pushing for a project or stop trying to collaborate with someone or these kind of things. So toxicity is a big one. The other thing is, you have to be individualist a bit. If you think that you're kind of wasting your time and you're not learning as much as you used to, and you're spending too much time doing these things, and you don't appreciate it necessarily, and you think there are better opportunities for yourself, it's not a bad idea to give up. And it's not really giving up. It's just choosing to understand what you want and deciding when to stop, I'd say. So these are the two things. Yeah,
that running to instead of running from is how I often like to think of it. You had the great book recommendation in there. Shifting gears, let's dive into the book. You're the author of this upcoming book from Manning called Real World Cryptography. Who is the audience for this book, and what can our listeners who are in that audience expect to learn from it?
So I'm the audience. I was the first one. And I heard that's actually a good thing if you're building a product, if you're the first user. But I pretty much wrote the book that I wish I had when I was a student, basically. When I was a student, I had this image of cryptography. And as I told you, I didn't really know what it meant to work or what skills are looked for, or what kind of work brings money or what is valued in the field and these kind of things. And as I started working, I was very lucky to be in a position where real world cryptographic work was thrown at me, and I had to audit work from big corporation like Google and Cloudflare and a number of ones that I cannot cite. And I kind of made me understand, I created my mental model of what's the real world, what's real world crypto. I wrote that really for myself, as in, this is what you need to understand if you want to get into this world of applied cryptography. If you want to build crypto systems or cryptographic applications, or if you want to review them, or if you want to understand how your product fits into this world. And that's really where I came from. Besides that, I can think of consultants. So I used to work in a pen testing firm where consultants would review code and would always run into cryptography, because it's really hard to do security without cryptography. And they had a number of questions for me, and I always answered their questions, and it kind of made me understood what sorts of questions people have or what sorts of questions are relevant in the field of security. The other thing now is that I work with developers, and I have a whole different set of other questions. And so I understand what sorts of questions developers have, what sorts of questions they're asking when they're building cryptography or trying to understand the product. And so these are the sorts of questions that I want to answer as well. So think of the audience as a very applied audience, developers and consultants and managers and production engineers and so on, but also students who want to become one of these type of engineers.
Yeah, that's so good. It's funny, I'm laughing because I wrote my book for me as well. I was like, here's the book I wish I had when I started on this. So I can very much relate to that. Real quick, you know, I'm just looking through the chapters on here. You've got things like hash functions, message authentication codes, key exchanges, randomness and secrets. I don't know, pick one of those that you think is exemplary of the types of things you're going to solve here. You know, make it real world. I don't know, make a hash function real world for the audience here of what they're going to learn in the book.
Yeah, so hash function is actually the first chapter. The reason is that it's probably the easiest primitive to understand or black box to understand. And that's something that people have used or usually understand. Maybe you've downloaded something on the internet and were given a hash. Maybe you didn't really know what to do with it. Or maybe you understood that you had to compare that hash with the hash of what you downloaded. So it comes up in these kind of situations. Or we see it more these days with secure messaging. So if you use WhatsApp or Signal or other secure messaging applications where conversations are encrypted end-to-end, meaning that if we talked on WhatsApp, for example, nobody else can see our messages but us, meaning that Facebook cannot see the messages. That's end-to-end encryption. And for that to work, you have to compare the safety numbers. Have you gone through that actually before?
Of comparing the numbers? Yes. Yeah, like comparing the hash functions?
Yeah. So for example, if we're talking on WhatsApp and we want to make sure nobody's observing our conversation, we can be sure 100% unless we go out of band, meaning we do a call or we meet, you know, in the street and we compare some numbers displayed in the application and we make sure that they match.
I have not done that explicitly, but, you know, I've done things like key signings, et cetera, which are, you know, kind of similar here, but, you know, we're getting down pretty low here. So
you should probably start verifying these safety numbers to make sure nobody's spying on you. Not everybody knows that, but it's good to verify, you know, to make sure. So this is how people usually interact with hash functions. The second thing is that also people understand people have heard of these CRC 32 or correcting code or error detection codes. When you send a message to someone, sometimes you have noise and that message might arrive with some errors in it. So usually what we do on the internet or in networks is that we put something next to the message, a short number that says this message is in the correct form. And you can verify that. And if there was some noise that actually modified the message in subtle ways, then you will be able to detect that with high probability. So people have these ideas also of these error codes, which are not like hash functions, but are somewhat similar. So that's an important distinction that I make in the book. So when you tell me like make it real world, usually I take this kind of idea of, okay, you have these numbers or these kind of like weird strings that are supposed to represent something. And if you modify that something, you can tell that it was modified thanks to that small number or like this weird string. And if you want to use that in cryptography, then you cannot use these error codes that we use in the real world because they're not cryptographically secure. And so I go on and I explain what does it mean to have a cryptographically secure hash function, and I explain the differences. So just to emphasize, what is a hash function? Because I guess I didn't really explain that. But just imagine a blender. And imagine that you want to put some ingredients in your blender and you're blending that. If you put the same ingredients, the exact same ingredients in your blender, it will always give you the same smoothie. And you can see the smoothie as the hash or digest. If you just tweak a bit the ingredients, it's going to give you a completely different smoothie. That's kind of the idea behind a hash function. It's something that you can give it, for example, a file, a picture, an image, a video, whatever you want, and it will give you a fixed size string, kind of a unique identifier. But if you modify like a bit in your image, right, like a pixel in your image, then it will give you something totally different. And so that's a good way to identify pictures or files if you on BitTorrent or commits in when you're using Git, all sorts of things.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And for our listeners here, you know, just I'll put in a plug for the book. I mean, this is the stuff that is going to become more and more important. And it's already a huge part of the backbone of the internet and the way we work. But with, you know, cryptocurrency, blockchain, so many other things going on, you know, at least being aware of how these things work is going to be a critical part of your ability to function in your role.
And actually, when you say blockchain, a blockchain is a very simple construction built only using hash functions. So that's the first and only construction you need to learn if you want to understand how a blockchain works.
There you go. I mean, that's fantastic. Do you need a math background to read the book, or is it primarily oriented towards programmers?
You don't need mathematics to some degree, meaning that I've done the work to make it as understandable as possible to people without a math background. Of course, I cannot avoid mathematics totally. There is some math and there are some complicated chapters, but you should be able to get through it as a developer without a math background. So I always have this anecdote that kind of pushed me to also write that book. So I used to give a cryptography class at Black Hat, a security conference. And one day a student came to me and asked me about a recommendation for a book or a course or something like that. And I gave him the recommendation of this Coursera class, cryptography one. And he told me that he tried and it was too theoretical. It was too much math. And at the time, I didn't agree with him. I was like, if you want to understand cryptography, this is it. You need to take that course. But later, I understood that actually he was very right and I was very wrong. And there's a lot you can learn about without getting into deep theories. That's the book I wrote. I wanted the book to have intuitions. I wanted it to show you black boxes and kind of show you, like, if you have this hash function as a black box, here's how you can use it. But if you're curious, let me show you what's inside the black box. And so I'm doing both in the book, right?
And I think maybe you answered this already, but what inspired you to go down the author path? I mean, that's a lot of work, right? I mean, you've got a day job, you're giving talks at DEF CON, things like that. You're out there. Why take on a book?
That's a good question, because that's a lot of work. It's not easy. It's really not easy. I think I took all the vacations I took this year were just working on the book, and probably the same last year. So it's a lot of time. It's a lot of compromises, but the reward is there for me. And I can tell you why. The first reason is that I love writing. I have a blog. I write a lot. I actually wrote a book before this one, a novel. So you probably have never heard of it, but I always had that passion for writing. And the second thing is that I also have a passion for education. And if you look into the kind of things I'm doing, I'm writing papers, I'm making videos on YouTube, I'm giving talks, I'm giving podcasts now. I'm trying to find different ways to teach and to explain different concepts using different means, right? And so I think the book was sort of missing in all the stuff that I've tried. And I also thought that there was a book that was missing in all the books of cryptography that you can find. So I was probably in a good place to fill that gap.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Those are really solid reasons to write a book. You certainly, you know, you don't get into it for the money, at least not directly. So you've got to have that deeper, broader meaning behind it, if you will. David, it's been amazing to have you on the show. I want two final questions for you. I want you to put on your mentoring hat for a moment. And, you know, what's your best career advice? What do you wish 18-year-old David knew about the working world, the real world, as it were?
Yeah, so one advice I can give is be careful what you get into, because the more work you do in some area, the more people ask you to do work there. So as you get into something, you quickly become a subject matter expert. And the upside is that if this is something you like, you'll be given more work in that area. If this is something you don't like, then it's very easy to get trapped. So be careful what decisions you're taking. Be careful what work you're saying yes to. And be careful how you use your personal time, because investing in things that you like will always end up in good situations and good opportunities.
That's a fresh take for me too. I'm still processing. I mean, first when you said be careful, I was like, oh, is, you know, like there's a cautionary tale in here. I mean, is there something behind this that has come forward for you in it, or is it more of an observation of, you know, just what you see around you?
It's something that I've seen, and it's something that I think I'm good at, is reserving the time to work on what I want to work on. And this always have ended up in me actually doing that work, because then people ask me to do this kind of work. And I've seen too many people getting trapped in something that they don't like, because they say yes to too many things that they didn't want to do. Then they become you know, the subject matter expert in something that they really didn't want to do in the beginning, and it's too late, you know. They're here sitting doing the same or digging deeper and deeper into this this thing that they didn't really want to do in the beginning. So maybe you find passion in it, and that's not uncommon. You can find passion by digging deeper into something that you didn't necessarily liked in the beginning. But I think it's good to consciously, you know, make that decision yourself. Here's what I want to do. I'll spend more of my time, I'll deviate more of my time towards doing these kind of things. Even though it might not be what I need to do in my day-to-day job, or not everybody's always asking me to do these things, I'll try and force this into my schedule. I'll try to force this into my maybe free time if I can do it, because it's worth it. 5 years down the line, you're doing something that you've always wanted to do and you thought was not possible because you didn't get a PhD in that field, or you're not an expert in that field, or anything like that.
I love it. I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, this, you see this so often. I see this a lot on this show. It's like you have kind of these chapters, and if you have that framing that you just gave, which is so wonderful, it allows you to step back from the thing that you're quote unquote an expert in the moment in, and detach your identity from it, and then go into a new area that you're curious in without feeling like, you know, you just gave up everything you've worked for. Yeah, that's really powerful. I appreciate you so much sharing that. David, last question for you, super easy. Where can our listeners buy your book, read your blog, watch your videos on YouTube, whatever it is, how can people better connect with you?
Yeah, so today you can find me, I have a blog, which is hard to spell. So it's Cryptology, but the French spelling. So CryptoLogie. And not gy at the end, .net. But the blog is in English, don't worry. That's probably the best place to find the book, my Twitter, my YouTube channel, and all these kind of things.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I was looking through it earlier and doing my research. A lot of good content on there, especially if you want to go really deep on all things cryptography. David, thank you so much for joining us. We'll, of course, be sure to link all of those up in the show notes. But thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
For sure. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are 3 ways you can help out. 1, make a donation via Patreon. 2, if you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3, buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.